Recording session number 112602.
Mr. T.R. Thornthwaite, Real Tomb. What kind of food were you getting, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Well, as I say, it was very basic, the food. There was the bacon and two slices of bread and this margarine for breakfast. But the margarine was that we used to call axle grease. It was horrible stuff, you know, and with it frozen, you couldn't spread it. Dinner time or lunch time, we used to get stewed meat, boiled potatoes and cabbage. Night time, you maybe get sausage, something, and bread. But as I said before, we're always hungry and used to march into these tables, and there was two slices of bread on the table to each place where you sat down. You marched down and then you turned inwards, and then when you were told to, you sat down and there was your two slices of bread in front of you. Well, times were marching in, turned round, and some lads was complaining to the sergeant that there was no bread in front of them. And they sent for the lance corporal who was running the dining room. He said there was two slices of bread on every section. So he said somebody must have taken it, and everybody was standing. So the sergeant followed us all in again and marched us outside, took us outside, followed in, and he says, right, take your jackets off, take your cardigans off, drop your trousers, looking for two slices of bread. None there. And they couldn't follow him. So we came back, sat down again, and they put some more bread there for the people that hadn't any. And a couple of days after, one sergeant says, right, come out, march out, and you got to hold the tables and turn them over. And there was two slices of bread with a fork stuck underneath. As they went, they got the two and stuck it underneath, you see, and then they sat down and had two underneath the table. And the sergeant, he'd catch them at it. And at night time, as I say, when you were allowed out, eventually, you could go out of the town, but we had no money and you couldn't buy nothing without any money. But if you stopped in at 8 o'clock, you got a pint pot of soup and a slice of bread. So we preferred to stop in for the pot of soup and a slice of bread than go out.
Was there any form of naffy service at this time?
Yes, there was a naffy there, small naffy. As I say, you didn't have a lot of money to throw around. Although, you know, when I think before I went in there, I was only getting 8 shillings a week, and out of that, I only got 1 shilling back pocket money. And when I left, when I got the garage, when I used to come up, on the Saturday, the green market, they had no refrigeration in those days, so they had to sell everything by 9 o'clock on the Saturday night. And I used to go there with my 1 shilling pocket money on the way home. And the bags, big carrier bag, used to get bigger and bigger because he had to sell it. And he used to say, right, who'll give me a shilling for this? And when they couldn't get any bigger, I used to give me a shilling, and I got this great big carrier bag of fruit. And I used to eat it on the way home. But as I said, that was only 1 shilling. And when I went in, I had 11 shillings. And then I had to spare the odds and ends, but that was left. But they used to go on a cup of tea or a... I forget what you used to call them, Dunkin' chocolate, 2 pence a bar, and it was big bar, but thick stuff, but it was very coarse chocolate. It wasn't like Cadbury's or anything like that, but it used to fill a hole. And
after breakfast, what were the kind of things you did after breakfast?
Well, after you had your breakfast, you went back to the barrack room, marched back, and whatever was on, you had to change into PT kit, if it was PT kit, or your full uniform, or your canvas, or whatever it is. And then 8 o'clock, you're outside, fell in, and you started your day's training until lunchtime, when you, an hour, I think it was, and you went, and then back again in the afternoon until 4 o'clock. This was doing all this basic training I mentioned before. 4 o'clock, you used to have to go on coal fatigue. And that was, there was a coal yard there, and you had these coal buckets about 2 foot in diameter and a tub affair, and one between two, and you had to fall in with a tub between you and go and fill them up at the coal yard, and then march to the barrack rooms and issue the coal for the fire. And then some had to go to the married quarters there and deliver their coal, the bucket. And then you come back, and then you got your tea. The tea was nearly always the same. Two slices of bread, margarine and marmalade, and a pot of tea. That was never any... Odd time, we got a piece of spice cake or something, you know, the odd time. But after I'd been there about 4 weeks, I was sent for. I had to go to the company office, and the captain in charge of the company said that my father was at the gate. And says, from what I hear, he can claim you out. He says, but it's up to you. And I said, I don't want to go out. I want to stop in. I didn't go at the gate. And I never seen my father from when I left home until 1943, October, when I came home. I came home. But I could have gone out. And they knew that I was only 16 and a half then, because my father told them, you see. But I carried on as 18. And even when I was coming to get the mob, I was worrying how it was going to work out with this records in Sibby Street. But it just fitted in. They just seemed to accept this sort of thing. You know? Must have gone on a lot. Well, from what I gather, it did go on a lot. People died joined long before the age.
Did you... in your leisure time, was there any gambling going on within the barracks?
No. Not at the depot. There was later on at the battalion, but never at the depot. There was never a gambling. Because you always, after you'd finish your tea and you come to the barrack room, you had to start cleaning your game. And everybody had a task, as they call them. And mine was a 6-foot wooden table, and I had to scrub it, and emery paper the metal on the side, ready to put on it in the morning. Other people had the coal bunk, as they call it, that the whitewash around the side and black lead the outside. And everybody had a job of some kind. And then you had to clean all your equipment. And by 9 o'clock, you used to get into your bed and you were only two sleep. You were asleep in seconds. You know, you went straight to sleep. never any trouble sleeping there.
Were there any particular parades or ceremonies that you were involved in as a trainee?
No. As far as I can't remember any, not at the depot, anyway. No.
Do you recall any particular officers of the time?
No, I can't remember the officers. All I remember is the corporal in charge of our squad, Ains squad, was a chap called Rigg. That's the only one. Oh, and there's a chap called Hall, Sergeant Hall. I never seen him anymore after the depot or during the war, but after the war, he was in the papers. He was in charge of the swing bridge, something to do with the swing bridge down the Tyne. Then the next thing, he got a write-up in the Chronicle. He was a commissioner at the Turk's Head Hotel in Grey Street, his top hat, and that was Nobby Hall. And there was a write-up about him being in the forces and that. Yeah. That's the only two I remember of the actual... the permanent staff there, you know.
Do you have any memories of your fellow?
Oh, yes, yeah. I remember the lad next bed to me called Dixie Dean. He'd been to Borstal and he was on a training ship. He come from Durham. And the first time we're allowed to go home, of course I didn't go home, but what I used to do, Sandy's Home, I called it Sandy's Home in Spittle Tongues. It was a something similar to the Salvation Army, but there was only about 12 beds. They're like cubicles. And you paid a shilling per night. And I used to stop there at the weekend instead of going home. I wouldn't go home. But this Dixie Dean, he used to go to Durham and he used to take his kit bag. And when he come back on a Sunday night, all the lights was out, because you were in the dark when you come back at night. And he asked, his kit bag was stotty cakes, filled right to the top with Stotty's cakes. His mother used to fill it up for him because he said he got nothing to eat. And he used to sit on his bed throwing them around the barrack room, his Stotty cakes, Dixie Dean. Eh? And another chap I got friendly with, was a some relative of Bainbridge's, the Doans. Now, I never did get the proper story from him, but from what I gather, he had an argument with his family and he just joined the army and he was in my squad. And as I say, we started going out together when we went down. And we went down, whoever, was it the two best kits of a monthly inspection, two of you could go to the Hippodrome. The Hippodrome used to be in Northumberland Road those days. And the two people with the best kits used to get two tickets to go there. So I went there with him. And I always remember the Tilly Girls was on. And he knew half them. I don't know how, from his background, but he knew them all. And of course I did. I wasn't very immature at 16 and a half. And there was that Bainbridge, but there was another Bainbridge. And the other Bainbridge was the one that murdered his father-in-law, Gated, before the war. And he got hung at Durham. That was the other Bainbridge.
Yet these rather rough types were not bullies. They weren't doing
any
bullying or threatening at all.
No, they weren't bullies. And another thing is, when you were out, if anybody got into trouble, you always had they always backed you up. You know, they would never leave you like they would today. Well, I don't know if they do it today or not, but they were a different. I don't know. Seemed because everybody they had nothing, and they seemed to share everything. And well, I wouldn't say share, but they were very good. I never had any complaints about them.
Was there much trouble with the townspeople when you were out at night? Were there many problems?
No, I can't remember ever having any trouble. No, we used to go down on a Saturday. We allowed out on a Saturday after 12 o'clock. And we used to go down to town and there was a Mary's. She's got a big cafe now in the town, but this one used to be in the Green Market up ahead. And we used to go there and used to pay sixpence for pie and peas and tea. We used to get a good big pie and a plate of peas and a pot of tea for sixpence. And we used to go there on a Saturday. But we didn't drink very much because we didn't have all the money to bloom and drink. And again, you couldn't go back to camp with any drink because you had to march back and you had to march in and report in. And I never seen any. We had a couple of blokes died, not in our squad, and another squad there. And what they did in those days, if anybody died, the kit was auctioned. Instead of handing in, it's all auctioned. We used to buy bits and pieces, and then the money went to his relatives, or whoever it was, his mother or something like that. I think I went on a funeral there, if I remember rightly. Somebody died. And I also remember the dentist. The dentist's chair was a wooden chair, and one arm was worn right down where people were with the dentist, because they're pretty rough in them days with the dentist. And the dentist would be working on you, and the other bloke would give you inoculation in the arm in the same chair. And when you got TB inoculation, it used to swell up. But the best thing for it was to keep moving. Well, what he used to do, he used to come, as you got inoculated, you come back to the barrack room and you were in the line and you had to scrub and you're on the floor, scrubbing the floors. And he used to scrub it and then you had to dry it and then put your polish on again. But that was the idea. Those that didn't do it for some reason, their arms used to swell up and they were real, with the TB inoculation. Effective different ways.
What was the overall discipline like?
Very strict. Oh, yes, very strict. I mean, double and stand to attention.
Did you find any difficult coping with the discipline?
Well, obviously, I was very low and homesick at the time, being so young. And I don't know, I thought my home upbringing was a little bit better than theirs. I don't know why, but and I felt a little bit out of place at the time. But I never had any trouble. But
what kind of disciplinary actions were taken against people that did break the rules?
Well, you got jankers, you know, you got CB, and you had to work after 5 o'clock when everybody's finished. You had to work at night and do parades and parade in the morning, do work before you start your own work. And then if it was severe, you went to detention. You went away to an army prison. But in those at the depot, there was nobody got detention because you were just discharged, finished. They wouldn't want, you know, didn't want you.
Mm. How long were you in training?
About 16 weeks, I think it was.
And did you get a leave at the end of it?
Got a week's leave. And again, I spent my week at the Sandy's home. And it was they were kind, but it was freezing, white partition there, and a little bed. That's nothing else. And I just lived 200 yards away up the road.
But you weren't going home.
I wouldn't go home.
So you went to Catrick. Can you recall the date that you went to Catrick?
I think about June. I think it was June we went to Catrick. And marched down to the station and got the train down to Catrick. And went to B Company.
And this was 1st Battalion, Durham Light Infantry?
1st Battalion, at Catrick, Mons Lines. Yeah. I've been there since and I couldn't recognise it. It's all so changed. And used to be a railway and everything down there in those days. Those are the days you used to get your dinner knife and they used to put you in a line to cut the grass with your dinner knife.
How were you received at Catrick when you first went? How were you received at Catrick?
Well, obviously, the everybody on us was old soldiers because to them we were new recruits, you see. So everybody was, plus the NCOs, everybody else was bossing us around. Again, we went into a barrack room, 24 in a barrack room. I went in B Company. I remember the company commander there. The company commander was called Sebag Montefiore. He was a millionaire, so they say. We had another nickname, was something the bag. It wasn't Sebag, it was something. But it was all right. But there were funny officers in those days, you know, the sort of just like us. They couldn't, you know, decide to run away from home or something, or they couldn't get on with the whatever it was, and they joined the army, I think. But Sebag was the company commander, and Sergeant Major Wilson was the sergeant major, and he was a canny bloke. I always remember him. The sergeant in charge of us, I can't remember his name, but I know when we went on leave from Catrick, we came back and he was under close arrest. He tried to break into the women's section of the Naffy when we were all on holiday. That was, I can't remember, Walker. He was one of these keep fit characters. He used to prance around on the grass in his little shorts and no sock, no shoes and that.
So how did you get on with the older, more experienced members of your company and section?
Yeah, well, of course, there was three of us, I think, went in this barrack room and all the rest were established people. In fact, some of them had been to India and they were come back and they were waiting for the discharge. I always remember this lad called Reilly. He'd been to India and his buttons on his stuff and his camp bag used to fascinate me. It was shiny, you know, worn with 7 years of clean and all the rest of them. And, of course, he was full of old tales and we used to take it all in, believe in everything and... we just had to learn from them and fit in.
Again, there was no bullying or...
No.
I never
met any bullying there. There was trouble, fights and things like that, but I wouldn't say it was bullying, you know. Then again, I was a good shot and I represent the Northern Command. The first leave we got after being at Catrick, I went on leave and I was stopped with the Raisins family who I joined up with. So when I come back to Newcastle, they were living at Whitley Bay, that was it. And I stopped with them at Whitley Bay. And it was 2 weeks leave, I think it was. But after a week, I had to go back to Carrick. And there was three of us. We had to train with the Lewis gun to represent the Northern Command. And we represent the Northern Command and won the cup from there. But I never got my leave back that they took off me. It was just very good. But that was at Carrick.
What kind of training were you doing now that you were with a regular battalion?
Well, there we started this manoeuvres in the Carrick Moors. Over in the moors, we used to do company training, brigade training, battalion training, route marches. And then we used to go to Strensel. We used to go to Strensel. We used to march from Carrick to Strensel to do firing on the open range with 303 ammunition. Now, I've talked to people since about Strensel, and I couldn't believe it, because when we used to go there, we were in bell tents, and they had about three permanent buildings, and they were the dining room and the officers' section. But all the rest was tents. And we used to live under canvas there and firing on the range at Strensel. Then we marched back to Carrick again.
And these route marches, were they again at infantry, light infantry pace, or was it a slower pace?
No, well, the 120 was a ceremonial march. When you, I forget what it was, about 100 and odd, 110, I think, when you're marching on the dunes. We used to do marching, and then we used to do what they call, you had to put your gas mask on, and you do quarter an hour running with all your gear and your rifle and that, and it's on the roads, and then quarter hours marching, quarter hours running, quarter hours marching. And, of course, with a gas mask on, you were blooming boasting. But what we used to do, we used to push a cigarette matchbox underneath to let the air come in.
What other gas training did you do with the gas mask?
Tear gas, you know, you used to do is tear gas and put you in the gas chambers. And
this was a chamber filled with the gas?
Full of, used to go in, and it was full of tear gas. And they shut the door. And they'd make you march and jump about and all the rest of it. And when you started sweating, it used to sting all around your face. And then you say, right, take your gas mask off. And the idea was to show you how efficient your gas mask was when you got the tear gas without it. And then they'd hold the door. And, you know, they thought they weren't going to let you out. And then you said, come out, and your blooming eyes are streaming. And you say, well, that's how good your gas mask is. And that was the... Then I used to do the training with gas, you know, the simulating the proper mustard gas and chlorine and all this sort of stuff.
And how was that done?
Well, it was more or less, I don't know what it was, but it was the idea was to, again, to show you how you didn't get it through your gas mask, you see. And then after a period, if you were exceptional good, you got jobs, like battalion jobs. Well, the first job I got was school board 10. I used to look after the classroom, prepare, get the fires on in the morning and prepare them, because the education used to be going on as well. And I remember I had difficulty again sitting me second class education. And I remember the sergeant who used to teach in this school, he says, we'll give you a tuition. He says, now you're in the classroom as an orderly. School orderly, and they helped me immensely, and I passed my second class certificate, and that gave you another threepence per day, you see. And the shooting with the rifle and the Lewis gun, if you got above a certain thing, you got your proficiency, that was another threepence a day. So that was a lot of money, sixpence. And then the officer, a captain, who used to take, the education officer, he used to be a bayonet fighting fanatic, and used to have a simulated rifle with a bayonet, but it was like a button on the end and a spring. And he started using me as a blooming trainee, and he's going to teach me bayonet fighting. He's just about pushed me through the petitions. And then again, this Corporal Raisin, I told you, was at the family. He was Northern champion of the pole vault. I used to go down every night with him and learn in the pole vault. And I was doing very well, but in them days you used to have a wooden thing where you put your pole in when you row, but it was just sand. And I went up this day and I came down and I'd been behind, just a basing spine right on this wooden box. And that put me right off pole vaulting after that. I just learned.
Can we go back to the education? What kind of subjects were you taking for these examinations?
Arithmetic and spelling and composition, things like that. History, you know, regimental history and all the battle honours, things like that. And then, of course, if you were any good, you could go and get your first class. But, I mean, there wasn't many went in for first class education. I had a friend who was self-educated. I used to knock around with him in China, and he got his first class, self-educated. And he's very good, clever lad. I used to go to the cinema with him in French concession, and it was all in French because he was learning French, you know.
Yeah. Do these examinations help you towards promotion?
Yes, oh yes, yes, uh-huh. Yeah. Yes, you, obviously, I mean, you had a certain amount of clerical work to do on your promotion from Lance Corporal. I did eventually get made Lance Corporal, but that was what they call the draft for going abroad to India. There was 40 of us, and I think it was 40. And I was made Lance Corporal for the voyage. So,
what kind of weapons were you learning to use at this time?
The rifle, Lewis gun, grenades, and revolver. That was the 45, the big thing he's done. And there was this other sections. Specialist sections had the machine gun, the Vickers machine gun, the mortars. That was it. And then there was the signal section. You go in for heliograph. We used to use heliograph in those days for message tones and telephone. As I said, all the transport was done by horse and limber. We'd had no mechanized at all, nothing there.
Did you have any anti-tank weapons?
No, nothing like that. In fact, the tanks, the tank corps was at Catterick, but the tanks were the same things as they had in the 1914 war, great big lumbering things. They were. No, we never, infantry had no anti-tank. I don't know about the artillery, and I don't think they do. I think they just have a Norman artillery shell. Of course, they weren't armoured like they were now. I mean, they were only protection against 303 ammunition, I think.
Did you find that any of the weapons you were using were particularly difficult in any way?
No. As I say, I seem to take to firing. I like firing, and as I say, I represent on command with the Lewis gun. And used to get a cross for whatever marksmanship. I had the rifles, I had the Lewis gun, I got marksman with the revolver. Yeah. I always remember the revolver range. It was the most dangerous range of the lot, revolver. You got six people lined up, and you have your revolver, and you stand like that, and you load it, and you stand, and the instructor's behind you, and he'll tell you, you know, he'll say, come up towards the target and at the same time start squeezing, and then when you get the target, squeeze the trigger. And when you'd finish firing, the chap used to go up to the target and he'd, with a paste pot, and put bits of paper over the holes if you'd hit it. And then he'd come behind. And I remember once we were standing there, we're all had loaded and we're like this, and this sergeant major, shorter burst the corn because you're only a little chap, said this chap, he says, so-and-so is going to tell me, and the lad turned around like this.
To face him.
And there was a sudden scatter. You had the, instead of putting it down, he turned around, and the thing went off, and the paint pot, the paste pot disappeared from this. All he had was the wire, and the paste pot disappeared. And this shorter verse, Almeida jumped on the back of this lad with a revolver. It was the safest place, and got a hold of his hand. But it was a very dangerous, it was worse than a grenade range, the revolvers. Because it's an automatic thing to do, you know. You,